with banked sensuality widened in amazement.
You do have fire.
I have a lighter, she interrupted defensively, but I don't smoke. She hastened to add, not in the mood to entertain the disdain of a man who was clearly an athlete of some kind. She'd taken up smoking 2 years ago during the Great Fit of Rebellion, right after she and her parents had quit speaking permanently, and then she'd ended up addicted. Now, for the third time, she'd quit, and by God she was going to be successful this time. His fingers closed over the lighter, and he assumed possession of it. As she stood beside him in the darkness, as he took her lighter away and the flame flickered out, she sensed that he would do the same with anything he wanted. Casually assume possession, wrap his strong hand around it, and claim it. She was surprised when he fumbled for several moments before he managed to press the little button that released the flame. How could he not know how to use a lighter? Even a health fanatic would have seen someone light a cigar or a pipe, if only on TV or in a movie. She suffered another attack of the shivers. When he resumed the pace, she followed him, the only alternative to remain by herself in the dark, and that was no alternative at all.
English,
he said softly.
Why do you call me that?
You haven't given me your name.
I don't call you Scotty, do I?
She said irritably, irritated by his strength, his arrogance, his blatant sexuality. He laughed, but it didn't sound like his heart was in it.
English, what is the month?
Oh boy, here we go, she thought. I did fall down one of Alice's rabbit holes.
Chapter 3 Drustan McKelter was worried. Although there was nothing he could put his finger on, apart from the remarkable fire she possessed, her shameless attire and her unusual manner of speaking, he couldn't shake the feeling that an even more significant fact was eluding him. Initially, he'd thought mayhap he was no longer in Scotland, but then she'd informed him he was a mere 3-day hike from his home. Mayhap he'd lost several days, even a week. He shook his head, trying to clear it. He felt the same as he had once before, when as a young lad he'd had a high fever and woken over a week later. Confused, thick-witted, his normally lightning-fast instincts slowed. His reactions were further dulled because lust was thundering through his veins. A man couldn't think clearly when he was aroused. All his blood was being sucked to one part of his body, and while it was one of his finer parts, cool and logical didn't describe it. The last thing he remembered, prior to awakening with the English lass sprawled so wantonly atop him, was that he had been racing toward the little lock in the glen behind his castle and growing unnaturally weary. From there, his memories were blurred. How had he ended up in a cave, a 3 days' hike away from his home? Why couldn't he remember how he had gotten here? He didn't seem to have suffered any injury. Indeed, he felt hearty and hale. He struggled to recall why he had been running toward the lock. He paused as a tide of fragmented memories washed over him. A sense of urgency, distant voices chanting, incense, and snatches of conversation.
He must never be found.
And a curious reply.
We will hide him well.
Had his petite English been there? Nay, the voices had been oddly accented, but not like hers. He quickly discarded the possibility that she had aught to do with his plight. She didn't seem the brightest lass, nor particularly strong. Still, a woman of her beauty didn't need to be. Nature had given her all the gifts she needed to survive. A man would use all his skills as a warrior to protect such lush beauty, even had she been deaf and mute.
Are you all right?
English nudged his shoulder.
Why did you stop? And please don't let the light go out, it makes me nervous.
Skittish as a foal, she was. Drustan pressed the tiny button again and flinched only mildly this time when the flame issued forth.
The month,
he asked roughly.
September.
Her reply hit him like a fist in his stomach. The last afternoon he recalled had been the 18th day of August.
How near Mabon?
She regarded him strangely, and her voice was strained when she said,
Mabon?
The autumnal equinox.
She cleared her throat uncomfortably. It is the 19th of September? The equinox is the 21st.
Christ, he'd lost nearly a month. How could that be? He pondered the possibilities, sorting and discarding until he struck upon one that horrified him because it seemed the only explanation that fit the circumstances. Once he'd been lured to the clearing, he'd been abducted. But assuming he had been abducted, how had he lost an entire month? The unnatural exhaustion he'd experienced while running toward the glen suddenly made sense. Someone had drugged him in his own castle. That was how his captors had managed to take him, and apparently they'd been keeping him drugged. And that someone could even now be returning to the cave to force him to slumber again. They would not find him so easy to take captive a second time, he vowed silently.
Are you all right?
She asked hesitantly. He shook his head, his thoughts grim.
Come,
he warned before he dragged her along behind him. She was so small that it would have been easier to toss her over his shoulder and run with her, but he sensed that she would vociferously resist such treatment, and he cared not to waste time arguing. She was fine-boned and petite, yet prickly as a hungry boar. She was also lushly curved and scandalously clad, and stirred a cauldron of lustful urges in him. He glanced over his shoulder at her. Whoever she was, wherever she was from, she was unaccompanied by a man, and that meant she was going home with him. The lass made his heart pound and his blood roar. When he'd awakened to find her on top of him, he'd responded fiercely. The moment he'd touched her, he'd been loath to let go, had slipped his hands up her silky legs, and been captivated by the notion that mayhap she removed all her body hair. He would find out as soon as his plight permitted. In the fierce highlands of Scotland, possession was 9/10 of the law, and Drustan MacKeltar was the other 1/10. Drustan was Breon, or lawgiver. He could recite the lineage of his clan back for millennia, directly to the ancient Irish druids of the Tuatha De Danann, a feat worthy of a druid bard. No one questioned his authority. He'd been born to rule.
Whence do you hail, English?
My name is Gwen Cassidy,
she said stiffly. He repeated her name.
'Tis a good name. Cassidy is Irish. I am Drustan MacKeltar, Laird of the Kelter. My people made their home in Ireland for many centuries, before we took these highlands as our home. Have you knowledge of my clan?
Why had he been abducted? And once taken, why not killed? What must his father be making of his disappearance? Then a worse thought occurred to him. Was his father still alive and unharmed? Fear for his father's safety gripped him, and he repeated his question impatiently.
Have you news of my clan?
I've never heard of your family.
You must hie from across the border. How came you here?
I'm on vacation.
On what?
Vacation. I'm visiting, she clarified.
Have you clan in Scotland?
No.
Then whom do you visit? Who accompanies you?
Women did not travel without escort or clan, and certainly not dressed as she was. Although she'd knotted a blue fabric about her waist before they'd left the main cavern, it failed to conceal her shocking undergarments. The woman had no shame at all.
No one accompanies me. I'm a big girl. I do perfectly well on my own.
There was a defiant note in her voice.
Have you any clan left alive, lass?
He asked more gently. Mayhap her family had been massacred, and she displayed her body reluctantly, in hopes of finding a protector. She comported herself with the stiff bravado of an orphaned wolf cub, conditioned by savagery and starvation to snap at any hand, no matter that it might hold food. She glared at him.
My parents are dead.
Oh, lass, I'm sorry.
Shouldn't you be busy trying to find a way out of here?
She changed the subject swiftly. He found the display of toughness, affected by a woman so obviously wee and helpless, touching. It was evident that the loss of her clan was still difficult for her to speak of, and far be it from him to press such a discussion. He knew too well the pain of losing a loved one.
Ugh, but 'tis just ahead. See the daylight sifting through the stones. We can break through there.
He let the flame go out, and they were swallowed by darkness, broken by a few thin trickles of light a dozen yards ahead. As they drew nearer, Gwyn eyed the rubble blocking the tunnel with disbelief.
"Even you can't move those boulders."
She knew so little about him. The only question was whether he would do it using his body or his other arts. Eager to be quit of the cave, he knew using his druid skills would be the fastest way out. It would also be the fastest way to ensure he would never get her in his bed. A display of such unnatural power had driven three of his betrothed from his life. The fourth had been killed 2 weeks past. Nay, he amended, a month and a half ago if it was truly almost Mabon, with his brother Dagus, who'd been escorting her to Castle Kelter for the wedding. He closed his eyes against a fresh wave of grief. It still felt like 2 weeks to him. He'd never met his bride-to-be. Although he mourned her death, he grieved the loss of a potential wife, grieved the cutting short of so young a life, not the woman herself. Dagus, on the other hand, that was a bitter and burning grief within his breast. He closed his eyes, firmly corralling the pain to be dealt with at a later time. Since his brother had died, it was even more critical that he beget an heir, and soon he was the last MacAltar left to sire sons. He glanced speculatively at Gwyn. Nay, he would use no druid magic to move the stones in her presence. He studied the stone blockade for a few moments before launching a simple physical assault. But he didn't merely put his arms into the job. He put his entire body into it, aware that she had dropped to her knees on the floor of the tunnel and was watching his every move. He might have flexed a bit more than necessary to demonstrate what a prize she might enjoy in her bed. Anticipation was an important part of bed play and heightened the woman's ultimate satisfaction immeasurably. Never let it be said he wasn't an expert and attentive lover. The seduction began long before he removed a woman's clothing. Women might not like the thought of wedding with him, but they vied in masses for the pleasure of his bed. Digging them out was a time-consuming task. From how tightly the stones were packed, the crevices between them sealed with the dust of time, he guessed this branch of the tunnel had collapsed a long time ago and been forgotten. He dug and tossed and cleared out the smaller rocks before turning his attention to the larger ones, using his axe as a lever to push and roll them. Before long, he had cleared a small passage. Thick foliage camouflaged the opening, and he could see why the tunnel had been forgotten. What had once been an entrance lay secluded between boulders and covered by bramble. Who would think to look for a cave in such a place? It was apparent that he hadn't been brought in via this tunnel. That much foliage couldn't have grown in a month. He glanced over his shoulder at her. She raised a guilty gaze from his legs, and he grinned.
"You have naught to fear," he assured her. "Freeing us is easy. 'Tis the hike that will be tiring."
"What hike?"
He didn't bother to answer her, but returned to his labor. The sooner they got out, the sooner he could devote attention to her seduction. Of course, it would have to happen while they were traveling back to his castle, for he dare not waste time. After widening the opening, he used his sword to hack through the dense overgrowth obscuring the entrance. When he'd finally cleared a passage he deemed safe enough to accommodate them, she hurried to his side. He realized she would bolt out the opening and sprint away if he gave her the opportunity.
"Step back while I go through," he commanded.
"Ladies first,"
she said sweetly. He shook his head.
"You would bound off faster than a hare were I such a fool."
He grasped her shoulders and pulled her close.
"I would advise against running from me. I would catch you easily, and the chase would only arouse me."
When she tried to shrug his hands off her shoulders, he said,
"Is this the fashion in which you thank me for freeing you?"
He teased.
"You might grant me a boon for my efforts."
He rested his gaze on her lips, making it clear what boon he had in mind. When she wet them nervously, he dropped his head closer, taking it as a sign of compliance. But the contrary lass flattened her wee palms on his cheeks and held him at bay.
"Fine. Go first, then. Age before beauty,
she added sweetly.
Arrogant lass, he said with a snort, grudgingly admiring her audacity. Give me your pack.
After producing the remarkable fire from within it, he was confident she wouldn't try to flee him without it in her possession.
I'm not giving you my pack.
Then you're not moving, he said flatly. And the longer I stand here, in such tempting proximity.
She smacked him in the chest with it, hard, and he laughed. Her cheeks flushed when he said,
Temper, temper, we English. 'Tis truly most becoming to you.
What a lovely spitfire she was, scarce taller than a child, but voluptuously curved and plainly old enough for carnal pleasure.
Aye, he'd take her back to Castle Keltar.
Mayhap she would prove an amenable companion, mayhap more. Mayhap she could be his fifth betrothed, he thought wryly, and perchance he'd actually get her to the altar. He'd not met a woman so uncowed by him. It was refreshing. With his height and size, not to mention whispers circulating about the MacKeltar in the Highlands, he frightened lasses more oft than not. He maneuvered himself through the opening, then took her hands and helped her scramble through, enjoying the feel of her small hands in his. Transferring his grip to her waist, he lifted her out. He didn't lower her to her feet right away, but gazed challengingly into her eyes as he slid her down his body, enjoying the firm thrust of her nipples against his chest. The friction was delicious, and he felt her knees wobble for a moment before she found her feet. If retreat was the measure of her desire, she desired him fiercely. She scrambled away from him with an alarmed expression the moment her toes touched the ground. He stared at her nipples, now puckered peaks beneath her chemise. She glanced down and defiantly crossed her arms across her lovely breasts, baring her teeth in a ferocious little scowl. He laughed, because she succeeded only in pushing the generous mounds together and up, increasing his desire to bury his face in her plump cleavage tenfold.
I said, do not run from me, he reminded. You could not hope to outdistance me.
He looked her up and down. Her skin, and he was seeing a splendid amount of it, was smooth and unscarred, bearing no sign of disease. Her waist was slim, her belly had the slight swell he adored on a wench, and although her hips were lush, he suspected she'd not yet borne bairn. The harsh light of day, oft unflattering to a wench, paid this one naught but tribute, and he bit back a groan. He'd not felt so intensely desirous of a woman ever before in his life.
Stop looking at me like that, she snapped.
His gaze collided with hers. She had eyes the color of a wild Scottish sea, and there was clear evidence of a storm brewing in the icy blue depths.
Why are you so prickly English? Is it because I am a Scot?
It's because you are overbearing, domineering, and pushy.
I am a man, he replied easily.
If men are allowed to behave in such an atrocious fashion, how are women supposed to act?
Appreciative. And among my clan we like them demanding in bed,
he added with a smile. When her gaze grew even cooler, he said,
You do not respond well to a jest. Be easy, Gwen Cassidy. I seek but to lighten your fears. You need fear not, lass. I will care for you, despite your bad blood. Even the English can learn.
On occasion, he added, just to provoke her. She growled, actually growled, low in her throat, as if he'd so irritated her that she'd like nothing more than to kick him. He found himself hoping she would. He was aching for an excuse to tussle with her and take her soft body down beneath his. Then he'd make her growl low in her throat for an entirely different reason, a moan of desire as he buried himself between her thighs. But feeble-minded though she might be, she knew better than to provoke contact. He could see it in her storm-filled eyes. Her lack of intelligence didn't seem to have precluded common sense. He drew a deep breath of fresh air and smiled. He was free of the cave, alive, and would soon be home. He would uncover the traitors and reward himself with the feisty Briton. Life was rich. thought the Laird of the MacKeltar. Chapter 4. Not a woman prone to violence, Gwyn was taken aback by her desire to kick Drustan MacKeltar. Not to slice and dissect him verbally, which would have been the mature thing to do, but to punch him, maybe even bite him the next time he touched her. Her mind went on instant extended sabbatical, just looking at him. She'd never met a man so hopelessly chauvinistic. He provoked the worst in her, dragging her down to a level as base and primitive as his own. She wanted to launch herself at him and pummel him. He was behaving as if, because he'd found her atop him, he owned her. Scottish lords obviously hadn't changed much over the centuries. She hadn't missed his proclamation that he was an authentic laird. Rather, she'd chosen to ignore it. He'd seemed to expect a curtsy or maidenly swoon, and she would not pander to his conceit. It appeared that centuries of submission to the English hadn't taught the Scots one damn thing about submission. He was likely one of those stuffy aristocrats who was fighting to restore Scotland's independence so he could swagger about in his kilt and regalia like a little king. He even preferred the archaic manner of speech affected centuries past. And he was definitely a womanizer. Smooth-talking, sexy, and entirely too touchy-feely. Probably dumb as a box of rocks, however, because all that brawn couldn't possibly couch too much brain.
"I have to return to the inn now," she informed him.
"There's no need for you to seek shelter in a common tavern. You will be generously housed in my demesne. I will see to your needs."
Possessively, he cupped his hand at the nape of her neck, tangling his fingers in her hair.
"I like the way you keep your hair. 'Tis unusual, but I find it most sensual."
Bristling, she tossed her bangs out of her eyes.
"Let's get something straight, MacKeltar. I am not going home with you. I am not going to bed with you, and I am not wasting one more moment arguing with you."
"I promise not to mock you when you change your mind, lass."
"Oh, contrary to what you might think, arrogance does not work as an aphrodisiac on me."
It was only a small lie. Arrogance alone didn't, but this particular arrogant man was a walking lollipop, and she was certain that latching her lips onto any part of him would satisfy the relentless oral craving she'd been fighting for 10 days, 7 hours, and 43 minutes. Not that she was counting.
"Aphrodisiac,"
he repeated slowly, brows furrowed. He was silent a moment. Then he said,
"Ah! Greek, Aphrodite, and Akos, mean you a love potion."
"Sort of."
How could he not know that word? She wondered, eyeing him warily. And why break it into Greek parts? When he grinned cockily, she dropped her gaze and pretended a sudden fascination with her cuticles. The man was too damn sexy for his own good, and standing way too close. He slid his hands into her hair and tugged gently, forcing her to look at him. His silver eyes glittered.
"Tell me, you do not feel mating heat between us. Tell me you do not desire me, Gwen Cassidy."
His gaze dared her to lie. Dismayed, she realized he could sense how much she wanted him, just as she could sense that he wanted to be all over her. So she did what handling insurance claims had taught her to do best. Deny, deny, deny.
"I do not desire you,"
she mocked lightly. Yeah, right. The sexual tension between them nearly qualified as a fifth force of nature. He inclined his head. A dark eyebrow rose and his gaze was amused, as if he were somehow privy to her internal dissenting opinion. One corner of his mouth lifted in a faint smile.
"When you finally speak the truth, it will be so sweet, we English. It will make me hard as stone, the mere words upon your lips."
She felt it imprudent to point out that he already was. When he'd buried his hands in her hair, he'd brushed that part of him against her. She was shocked to realize she was actually contemplating having impulsive sex with him, trying to decide what was the worst that could happen if she did, as many people she knew did. Just hopped into bed with a stranger. God, he was so tempting. She wanted to experience passion, and when he looked at her the way he was looking at her right now, she felt an epiphany might be a hot, slippery kiss away. But he was headstrong, too gorgeous for anyone's peace of mind, a wildly unpredictable variable in a risky equation, and she knew what those could do, create chaos. The nervous flutter in her stomach, the desire she felt was too novel a sensation for her to act upon it without careful consideration. Although she wanted to change her life and was determined to lose her virginity, she was beginning to realize that it wasn't as easy to change one's ways as she thought it would be. Thinking about having sex with a virtual stranger was a whole lot different than actually plunging right into the heat and nakedness and rawness of it, especially when that virtual stranger was so much man, a little odd, and a lot overwhelming. Her newfound feelings of desire scared her. The intensity of her body's reaction to him scared her. Perhaps she could do it with him on the last day of her trip, she mused. He was certainly willing. She could have what she knew would be heart-pounding sex, then fly back home and never have to see him again. She'd brought condoms before leaving the States, and they were tucked safely in her pack. Sheesh, was madness contagious? What on earth was she thinking? A brisk shake of her head restored her sanity.
Come, he said.
I'd like to, but you're way too dangerous, she thought with a sigh.
Since he was heading down the hill in the general direction of the inn, she followed.
You don't have to hold my hand, she protested. I'm not going to run off.
His eyes crinkled with silent amusement as he released her.
I enjoy holding your hand, but you may walk beside me, he informed her.
I wouldn't walk anywhere else,
she muttered. Behind would feed his ego, although she'd get to watch his incredible body unobserved. In front, she'd be miserable, feeling his gaze on her. Beside him was the only tolerable place. He took long strides, his natural pace a lope for her, but she refused to complain. The faster he walked, the more quickly she could surround herself with the safety of the teeming village. She'd never dreamed she'd be so grateful to see a busload of senior citizens in her life. Busy plotting her polite but hasty retreat from his presence, she didn't realize he'd stopped until he was quite some distance behind her. She turned and gestured impatiently, but his eyes were on the village below.
Come on! She shouted.
He didn't appear to hear her. She called for him again, waving her arms to get his attention, but he remained motionless, his gaze locked on the view.
Fine, she decided. This is a great time to leave, and I have a head start.
She broke into a sprint down the sloping hillside, stretching her legs as if running for her very life. She suddenly felt silly. If the man had truly planned to harm her, he could have done so long before now. Still, she couldn't shake the feeling that she was leaving something incredibly dangerous behind her on the hillside, far more than a simple man, and it was wiser that she did so now. She ran for several seconds before the missile blasted her from behind. She stumbled and landed on her stomach in a springy patch of purple vetch, trapped beneath his body. He stretched her hands above her head and pressed her against the ground.
I said, do not run from me, he gritted out. Which word did you have difficulty with?
Well, you stopped moving, Gwen argued. I called for you, and ouch, damn it, now I hurt all over.
When he didn't respond, only raised his body slightly off hers so she could breathe, she became aware of a subtle change in him. His heart was thundering against her back, his breathing was shallow, and his hands were trembling atop hers.
What's wrong?
She asked faintly.
What horror could make such strong hands tremble?
He pointed to a car, disappearing down the winding road beneath them.
What in the name of all that is holy is that?
Gwyn squinted.
It looks like a VW, but I can't tell from this distance. The sun's in my eyes.
A what?
Volkswagen.
A what wagon?
Volkswagen, a car.
Was the man going deaf?
And that?
His cheek brushed her temple as she turned her head to gaze where he pointed.
What?
She blinked owlishly. He appeared to be pointing at the inn.
The inn?
Nay, that bright thing with colors such as I have never seen. And what of all those leafless trees? What has happened to the trees, and why have they tied cords between them? Think you they will run away if not tethered? Never have I seen oaks so shamed.
Gwyn eyed the neon sign above the inn, and the telephone poles in wary silence.
Well, lass.
He took several slow, deep breaths, then said unsteadily,
None of this was here before. I have seen naught of such oddities. It looks as if half the clans in Scotland have settled about Brodie's Lock, and I am quite certain he wouldn't approve of all this. He is a most private man.
He rolled off her and flipped her over, then pulled her up so she was on her knees facing him. He cupped her shoulders and shook her.
What is a car? What purpose has it?
Oh, for heaven's sake, you know what a car is. Stop pretending. You've been pretty convincing as the archaic lord, but don't play any more games with me.
Gwyn glared at him, but beneath her anger he was frightening her. He had the most bewildered expression on his face, and she thought she glimpsed a hint of fear in his brilliant eyes.
What is a car?
He repeated softly. Gwyn began to make a caustic comment, then hesitated. Perhaps he was sick. Perhaps the situation was infinitely more dangerous than she thought.
It's a machine powered by a battery and gas?
She abruptly decided to humor him, giving him the short answer.
People travel in them.
Soundlessly, his lips formed the words battery and gas. He was very still a moment, then.
English?
Gwyn,
she corrected.
Are you truly English?
No, I'm American.
American, I see. Well, not truly, but Gwyn.
What?
His questions were starting to scare her.
In what century do I find myself?
The breath locked in her throat. She massaged her temples, assailed by a sudden headache. It figured that a man who dripped such raw sex appeal had to be fatally flawed. She had no idea what to say to him. How did one answer such a question? Dare she get up and simply walk away, or would he tackle her again?
I said, what century is it?
He repeated evenly.
The 21st,
she said, closing her eyes. Was he playing a game? The bold block letters of a newspaper headline blossomed against the insides of her eyelids, crowding out all rational thought. Dropout daughter of world-renowned physicists abducted by escaped mental patient. Subtitled, She Should Have Listened to Her Parents and Stayed in the Lab. He fell silent. And when she opened her eyes, he was scanning the village below. The boats on the lock. The buildings, the cars, the bright lights and signs, the bicyclists in the streets. He cocked his head, listening to the blat of horns honking, the buzz of motorbikes, and from some cafe, the rhythmic bass of rock and roll. He rubbed his jaw, his gaze wary. After some time, he nodded, as if he'd resolved an internal debate he'd been having.
Christ.
He half whispered, aristocratic nostrils flaring like a cornered animal.
I haven't lost a mere moon. I've lost centuries.
A mere moon? Centuries? Gwyn pinched her lower lip between her finger and thumb, riveted. Then he looked back at her, eyed her shirt, her pack, her hair, her shorts, and finally her hiking boots. He tugged her foot out from beneath her, held it in his hands, and studied it for a long moment before raising his eyes to hers again. His dark brows dipped.
You name your stockings?
What?
He ran his finger over the words, Polo Sport, stitched on the thick woolen cuff of her sock. Then his gaze fixed on the small tab on her hiking boots. Timberland. Before she could form a reply, he said,
Give me your pack.
Gwyn sighed and started to hand it to him. then unzipped the main pouch first, not in the mood to get into a discussion about zippers. Considering the one on her shorts, if he truly didn't know how they worked, she wasn't in a hurry to teach him. Women should sew padlocks on their zippers with him around. He took the pack and dumped the contents on the ground. When her cell phone fell out, she was momentarily furious with herself for forgetting it, until she recalled that it wouldn't work in Scotland anyway. As he withdrew it from the jumble of her belongings, she realized it wouldn't work, ever again. The plastic casing had been crushed in one of her many falls, and it broke into pieces in his hands. He eyed the tiny technology inside with fascination. He sorted through her cosmetics, pried open a compact, and regarded himself in the small mirror. Her protein bars were tossed aside, along with the box of condoms, thank heavens, and when he spied her toothbrush, his bewildered gaze swept from her long, thick hair to the tiny brush and back to her hair again. One brow arched in an expression of doubt. He picked up the latest issue of Cosmopolitan, eyed the picture of the half-clad model on the cover, then fanned rapidly through it, gawking at the brilliantly colored pictures. He ran his fingers over the pages as if stunned.
"And Sylvan thinks his illuminated tomes are lovely," he muttered.
When he started sorting through her brightly colored panties, she'd had enough. She closed her fist over the lime silk thong he was currently examining and firmly shook her head. But when he looked at her, she realized that for the first time since they'd met, seduction was not on his mind. Her desire to flee was abruptly vanquished by the look of anguish on his face, and she wasn't so certain anymore that he was playing with her. If he was, he was a consummate actor. Plucking the magazine from his hands, she pointed out the date in the corner. His eyes widened even further.
"What century did you think it was?"
she asked, disgusted with herself for being a sucker for a gorgeous man. He evidenced no intellect, had no redeeming qualities, yet drew her like a fluttery moth to a flame, and so what if she made ashes of her wings?
"The 16th,"
he replied hollowly. He sounded so distraught that she touched him, brushing her fingers against his chiseled jaw, lingering longer than was wise.
"McKelter, you need help,"
she soothed,
"and we'll find you help."
He closed his hand over hers, turned his head and kissed her palm.
"My thanks. I am pleased you come so swiftly to my aid."
She withdrew her hand quickly.
"Come with me to the village, and I'll get you to a doctor. You probably fell and have a concussion,"
Gwyn said, hoping it was true. The alternative was that he had been wandering around God only knew how long, thinking he was some medieval lord, and she just couldn't reconcile the powerful, arrogant man with a delusional, paranoid schizophrenic. She didn't want him to be sick. She wanted him to be just as he appeared to be, competent and strong and healthy. It seemed impossible that a mental case could be so commanding, regal.
"Nay,"
he said softly, his gaze drifting to the date on the magazine again.
"We go not to your village, but to Bandrocade,"
he said finally.
"And we haven't much time. It will be a hard journey, but I will tend you gently when we arrive. I shall see you handsomely rewarded for your assistance."
Oh God, he meant to take her to his castle. He really was over the top.
"I'm not going to those stones with you,"
she said as calmly as she could under the circumstances.
"Let me take you to a doctor. Trust me."
"Trust me,"
he said as he pulled her to her feet beside him.
"I need you, Gwyn. I need your help."
"And I'm trying to give it to you."
"But you do not understand."
"I know you're sick."
He shook his dark head, and in the late afternoon light his silver eyes were clear, level, and intelligent. No crazed glimmer lurked there, only concern and determination.
"Nay, I am well, and in no way touched as you are thinking. You will simply have to see for yourself."
"I'm not coming with you,"
she said firmly.
"I have other things to do."
"You must forego them. The Keltar takes precedence, and in time you will understand. Now, I ask you a last time, do you come with me of your own free will?
Not a chance in hell, barbarian!
When he wrapped his hand about her wrist, she realized that while they were arguing, he'd removed a chain of sorts from somewhere on his body. When he closed the metal links about her wrist and bound her to him, she opened her mouth to scream, but he clamped a powerful hand over her mouth.
Then you come with me of my will alone. So be it.
Chapter 5 Nearly 500 years, Drustin brooded. How could that be? He felt as if only yestereen he'd gone riding in the heather-filled highland meadows of his home. His mind reeled from shock, and try though he might to deny it, he knew it was true. He knew it with a Gnostic bone-deep knowing that was unquestionable. Her time felt different. The natural rhythm of the elements was frenetic, fractured. Her world was not a healthy one. Centuries had passed, and he had no idea how it had happened. Probing his memory had yielded no additional facts. 5 centuries of slumber seemed to have muted his memory, dimmed the events that had occurred just prior to his abduction. All he knew was that he'd been lured into some sort of ambush in which a number of people had participated. There had been armed men. There had been chanting and fragrant smoke, which reeked of witchcraft or druidry. He'd obviously been drugged. But then what? Enchanted by a sleep spell? And if he'd been spelled, by whom? Still more important, why? The why of it would tell him if his entire clan had been targeted. An icy finger of dread brushed his spine as he considered the possibility that they'd been attacked for the lore they protected. Had someone finally believed the rumors and come seeking proof? The Keltar males were druids, as their ancestors had been for millennia. But what few knew was that they were not simple druids, struggling with mostly incomplete lore since the loss of so much of it in the fateful war millennia ago. The Keltars possessed all the lore and were the sole guardians of the Standing Stones. If, after he'd been abducted, his father, Sylvan, had been killed by his abductors, the sacred lore would be lost forever, and the knowledge they protected, to be used only when the world had dire need, vanquished utterly. He glanced at Gwyn. If she hadn't awakened him, he might well have slumbered for eternity. He murmured a silent prayer of thanks. Pondering his situation, he realized that for now the how and why of his abduction were irrelevant. He would find no answers in her time. What mattered was action. He'd been blessed enough to have been awakened and had both the chance and the power to correct things. Yet to do so, he must be at Bandracade by midnight on Mabon. He glanced at her again, but she refused to look at him. Dusk had long since fallen, and they'd made good time, putting many miles between them and the horrifying, noisy village. In the moonlight, her smooth skin shimmered with the warm richness of pearl. He indulged himself, envisioning her nude, which wasn't hard to do when she wore so little. She was all woman, and brought out the most primitive man in him, a fierce need to possess and mate. Her nipples were clearly visible beneath her thin shirt, and he ached to suckle them in his mouth. She was a fiery wee lass with a spine of steel and curves that would lure even his devout priest Nevin's gaze. He'd gotten hard the moment he'd opened his eyes and looked at her, and had been uncomfortably erect since. One flirtatious glance from her would return him to a painful state, but he didn't worry over much that she might cast him such a look. She hadn't spoken to him in hours, not since he'd refused for the 100th time to release her. Not since he'd told her he would toss her over his shoulder and carry her if he had to. It intrigued him that she'd neither screamed nor fainted nor pleaded for release. His first impression of her had not been entirely accurate, although it was difficult to discern, what with her strange manner of speaking. She did possess a dash of intelligence. She demonstrated fine reasoning abilities while trying to talk him out of taking her along, and when she'd realized there was no possibility of him relenting, she treated him as if he simply didn't exist.
"Bravo, Gwyn," he thought. "Cassidy is Irish for clever. Gwendolyn means goddess of the moon. Quite a fascinating lass you're turning out to be."
Whereas initially he'd thought her an orphan or survivor of a clan massacre, a woman willing to barter her body to secure a protector, thus explaining her clothing and demeanor, it had since occurred to him that she might simply be typical of her time. Mayhap in 5 centuries women had changed this much, become tenaciously independent. Then why, he wondered, did he sense a silent sadness, a brush of vulnerability in her that belied her bravado? He knew she thought that he'd dragged her off because he desired her, and would that it were that simple. There was no denying that he found her mesmerizing, and was impatient to bed her. But things were suddenly much more complicated. Once he'd discovered he was stranded in the future, he'd realized he needed her. When they arrived at the stones, if the worst was true and his castle was gone, there was a ritual he must perform. His conscience be damned. There was a possibility the ritual would go wrong, and if that happened, he needed Gwyn Cassidy standing by his side. She was growing weary, and he felt a pang of regret for causing her distress. When she stumbled over a tree root and fell against him, only to hiss and jerk away, he softened. He would give her this one night, for after tomorrow there would be no stopping. She nearly fell where she stood, so he cupped one arm behind her shoulders, the other behind her knees, and deposited her on the mossy trunk of an enormous tree that had fallen to the floor of the forest. Perched upon the massive trunk, with her feet dangling several inches above the ground, she looked wee and delicate. Warrior hearts did not always come in warrior-strong bodies, and although he could hike 3 days without rest or food, she would not fare well under such conditions. He boosted himself up onto the trunk beside her.
"Gwen,"
he said gently. There was no response.
"Gwen, I truly will not harm you,"
he said.
"You already have,"
she retorted.
"You're speaking to me again?"
"I'm chained to you. I had planned to never speak to you again, but I've decided that I don't feel like making things easy for you, so I'm going to tell you incessantly and in vivid detail precisely how miserable I am. I'm going to stuff your ears with my shrill complaints. I'm going to make you wish you'd lost your hearing when you were born."
He laughed. This was his scornful English again.
"You are free to torment me at every opportunity. I regret causing you discomfort, but I must. I have no choice."
She arched one brow and regarded him with disdain.
"Let me be certain I understand the situation. You think you are from the 16th century. What year exactly?"
1518.
"And in 1518 you lived somewhere near here?"
"Aye."
"And you were a lord?"
"Aye."
"And how is it that you ended up sleeping in a cave in the 21st century?"
"That is what I must discover."
"McKelter, it's impossible. You seem relatively sane to me, this delusion excluded. A bit chauvinistic, but not too abnormal. There is no way a man can fall asleep and wake up nearly 5 centuries later. Physiologically, it's impossible. I've heard of Rip Van Winkle and Sleeping Beauty, but those are fairy tales."
"I doubt the fairy had aught to do with it. I suspect gypsies or witchcraft,"
he confided.
"Oh, now that's infinitely reassuring,"
she said too sweetly.
"Thank you for clarifying that."
"Do you mock me?"
"Do you believe in fairies?"
she countered.
"Fairy is merely another name for the Tuatha De Danann. And yes, they exist, although they keep their distance from mortal man. We Scots have always known that. You have lived a sheltered life, have you not?"
When she closed her eyes, he smiled. She was so naive. She opened her eyes, favored him with a patronizing smile, and changed the subject as if not wont to press his fragile mind too hard. He bit his lip to prevent a derisive snort. At least she was talking to him again.
"Why are you going to Bandricade, and why do you insist on taking me with you?"
He weighed what he might safely tell her without driving her away.
"I must get to the stones, because that is where my castle is."
"Is or was? If you expect to convince me you are truly from the 16th century, you're going to have to do a little better with your verb tenses."
He glanced at her reprovingly.
Was, Gwen. I pray it stands still.
It must be so, for if they arrived at the stones and there was no sign of his castle, his situation would be dire indeed.
So you're hoping to visit your descendants? Assuming, of course, that I'm playing along with this absurd game, she added.
Nay, not unless his father at 62 had somehow managed to breed another bairn after Drustan had been abducted, which was highly unlikely since Sylvan had not tupped a woman since Drustan's mother had died, as far as Drustan knew. What he was hoping for was some of the items in the castle, but he couldn't tell her any of that. He couldn't risk scaring her off when he needed her so desperately. He needn't have bothered searching for a suitably evasive reply, because when he hesitated too long for her liking, she simply forged ahead with another question.
Why do you need me?
I do not know your century, and the terrain between here and my home may have changed.
He offered the incomplete truth smoothly.
I need a guide who has knowledge of this century's ways. I may need to pass through your villages, and there could be dangers I would not perceive until it was too late.
That sounded rather convincing, he thought. She was regarding him with blatant skepticism.
Gwen, I know you think that I've lost my memory, or am ill, and am having fevered imaginings, but consider this. What if you are wrong, and I am telling you the truth? Have I harmed you? Other than making you come along with me, have I injured you in any way?
No,
she conceded grudgingly.
Look at me, Gwen.
He cupped her face with his hands so she had to look directly into his eyes. The chain rattled between their wrists.
Do you truly believe I mean you ill will?
She blew a strand of hair out of her face with a soft puff of breath.
I'm chained to you. That worries me.
He took a calculated risk. With an impatient movement, he released the links, counting on the mating heat between them to keep her from outright fleeing.
Fine. You are free. I misjudged you. I believe that you were a kind and compassionate woman, not a faint-hearted lass who cannot abide anything that she does not immediately understand.
I am not faint-hearted.
And if a fact doesn't adhere to your perception of how things should be, then it cannot be.
He gave a derisive snort.
What a narrow vision of the world you have.
Oh!
Gwyn scowled, scooting away from him on the fallen tree trunk. She swung one leg across it, straddling the massive trunk, and sat facing him.
How dare you try to make me feel bad for not believing your story? And I assure you I do not have a narrow view of the world. I'm probably one of the few people who doesn't. You might be astounded by how broad and well-informed my vision of the world is.
She massaged the skin on her wrist, glaring at him.
What a contradiction you are,
he said softly.
At moments, I think I see courage in you. Then at others I see naught but cowardice. Tell me, are you always at odds with yourself?
A hand flew to her throat, and her eyes widened. He'd struck something sensitive. Ruthlessly he pursued it.
Would it be so much to ask that you give a bit of your precious time to help someone in need, the way they wish to be helped, rather than the way you think they should be helped?
You're making it sound like everything is my fault. You're making it sound like I'm the one who's crazy,
she protested.
If what I say is true, and I vow it is, you do seem most unreasonable to me,
he said calmly.
Has it occurred to you that I find your world, without any knowledge of the ancients, with limbless, leafless trees, and clothing with formal appellations, as unnatural as you find my story?
Doubt. He could see it on her expressive face. Her stormy eyes widened further, and he glimpsed that mysterious flash of vulnerability beneath her tough exterior. He disliked provoking her, but she didn't know what was at stake, and he couldn't possibly tell her. He didn't have time to go out into her world and seek another person. Besides, he didn't wish any other person. He wanted her. She'd discovered him, she'd awakened him, and his conviction that she was supposed to be involved in helping him correct things increased with each passing hour.
"There are no coincidences in this world, Drustan," his father had said. "You must see with the eagle's eye. You must detach, lift above a conundrum, and map the terrain of it. Everything happens for a reason if you can but discern the pattern."
She massaged her temples, scowling at him.
"You're giving me a headache."
After a moment, she blew out a resigned breath, fluffing her bangs from her eyes.
"Okay, I give up. Why don't you tell me about yourself? I mean, who you think you are."
A rather begrudging invitation, but he would work with what he could get. He hadn't realized how tense he had been, awaiting her response, until his muscles smoothed beneath his skin.
"I have told you that I am Laird of MacLan, despite the fact that my father, Sylvan, still lives. He refuses to be Laird any more, and at 62 I can scarce blame him. 'Tis a long time to bear such responsibility."
He closed his eyes and took a deep breath.
"I had a brother, Dagus, but he died recently."
He didn't mention that his betrothed had been killed while accompanying Dagus back to Castle Keltar for the wedding. The less said about any of his betrothed's to another woman, the better. He was touchy about the entire subject.
"How?"
she asked gently.
"He was returning from the Elliot's estate when he was killed in a clan battle that wasn't even our own, but between the Campbell and the Montgomery. Most likely, he saw the Montgomery was severely outnumbered and tried to make a difference."
"I'm so sorry,"
she said softly. He opened his eyes to find compassion shimmering in her gaze, and it warmed him. When he lowered himself from the massive trunk of the fallen tree and pulled her leg over the trunk so she faced him, she didn't resist. With him standing on the ground and her perched upon the trunk, they were at equal eye level, and it seemed to make her feel more comfortable.
"Dagus was like that,"
he told her with a mixture of sorrow and pride.
"He was ever one to fight others' battles. He took a sword through the heart. And one bitter morn I woke up to the sight of my brother, trussed across the back of his horse, being escorted home by the captain of the Elliot Guard. And grief rips at my heart. Brother of mine, I failed both you and Daw," he thought.
Her brows puckered, mirroring his sorrow.
"Your mother?"
she asked gently.
"My father is widowed. She died in childbirth when I was 15. Neither she nor the babe survived. He has not remarried. He vows there was only one true love for him."
Drustin smiled. His Da's sentiment was one he understood. His parents' match had been made in heaven, he a druid and she the daughter of an eccentric inventor who'd scoffed at propriety and educated his daughter better than most sons. Unfortunately, educated lasses were hardly in abundance in the Highlands, or anywhere else for that matter. Sylvan had been lucky indeed. Drustin had longed for such a match himself, but time had worn him down, and he'd given up hope of finding such a woman.
"Are you married?"
Drustin shook his head.
"Nay, I would not have tried to kiss you were I betrothed or wed."
"Well, score 1 point for men in general,"
she said dryly.
"Aren't you rather old never to have been married? Usually when a man hasn't married by your age, there's something wrong with him,"
she provoked.
"I've been betrothed,"
he protested indignantly, not about to tell her the number of times. It wasn't a fine selling point, and she was closer to the truth than he would have liked. There was indeed something wrong with him. Once women spent a bit of time with him, they packed up their bags and left. It was enough to make a man feel uncertain of his charms. He could see she was about to press the issue, so he said hastily, hoping it would end the discussion of the subject.
"She died before the wedding."
Gwyn winced.
"I'm so sorry."
They were silent a few moments. Then she said,
"Do you want to get married?"
He arched a teasing brow.
"Are you offering for me, lassie?"
he purred. If only she would, he'd like as not snatch her up and marry her before she could change her mind. He found himself more intrigued by her than he'd ever been with any of his betrothed. She flushed.
"Of course not. I'm merely curious. I'm just trying to figure out what kind of man you are."
I wish to wed, and have bairn. I simply need a good woman,"
he said, flashing her his most charming grin. She wasn't unaffected by it. He saw her eyes widen slightly in response, and she seemed to forget the question she'd been about to ask. He breathed a silent thank you to the gods who'd gifted him a handsome face and white teeth.
"And what would a man like you consider a good woman?"
she said after a moment.
"Wait."
She raised a hand when he would have spoken.
"Let me guess. Obedient, adoring, definitely not too bright,"
she mocked.
"Oh, and she'd just have to be the most gorgeous woman around, wouldn't she?"
He cocked his head, meeting her gaze levelly.
"Nay, my idea of a good woman would be one I